Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, we take up a challenge from writer Jean Luan Yang about reading without walls. He thinks of this as reading outside your comfort zone, and he's been traveling the country urging kids to make a practice of this. Like if you're hooked on comic books, give a graphic novel or a biography a try. Jean is convinced that this is the way to raise curious, empathetic, and well-rounded kids, but I think this is such an essential idea that we should take this up as adults, too. I'll share my own example of being pushed out of my comfort zone on this in a few minutes. But as our roundtablers discuss this, I want to hear from you on Twitter. What was the last book that really challenged your worldview? A book that isn't something you'd typically read? And talk to me about what that experience was like. And yes, do that in 140 characters on Twitter. But I want to know about the experience of reading outside your comfort zone. What was the book that really ushered you into that experience? You can reach me on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, Anitra Budd is a writer and an assistant visiting professor at McAllister College. Welcome. Great to have you in the roundtable.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sarah Park Dahlen is an associate professor of library and information science at St. Kate. Sarah, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi. Thanks. It's nice to be back.
And Matt Kelleher is basically he knows what you want to read before you even know it. Because are you running the show at Subtext these days? Can I just say that?
I make it home, yeah.
All right, good. Good to have you here, Matt. Welcome
Glad
back.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Anitra, I'm the first to admit that if I didn't have to read all kinds of different stuff for work here at NPR, I'd probably slip right back into the comfy zone of female detective stories, women who really kick it, and historic literary fiction. Mm-hmm. Those are my places. What's your comfy zone of reading, and how do you push yourself outside of it?
Well, my tendency, besides spunky preteen girls, I love that. I just love that as an area. But I tend to read a lot of fairly experimental, genre-busting literary fiction. The Curfew by Jesse Ball, like things that sort of cross back and forth, you know, like is it speculative? Is it realistic? What's happening? And the way that I, besides work, so I am also an editor. So sometimes I'm forced to read outside of my comfort zone purely because I need to know where an author is coming from.
Right.
I had to work on a very long sort of political-based book, and that was definitely not my area. I was not interested in reading behind-the-scenes politics.
That really challenged you.
Yes, yeah. It really did. And so when I knew that project was coming down the pipe, I started reading, like, as much as I could. And it was hard at first, but it was a good kind of pressure. So sometimes I let work sort of dictate, you know, getting me out of that, you know, very nice, dreamy Calvino literary mode and kind of pushing me towards something that I wouldn't otherwise read.
I have to say, your comfy zone sounds pretty uncomfortable to me. The fact that you're reading all that experimental. Matt, why do you think we slip into these comfort zones of reading? You recommend a lot of books to a lot of people that show up at Subtext. What is it about feeling so surrounded and comfortable with the books that we go back to or the genres that we go back to over and over again?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with people wanting to be entertained with what they're reading and wanting to feel like they're not, you know, that it's that comfort is like a warm hug.
Right.
Like when you just don't feel like you have to stretch yourself to engage with the work a little bit.
You know what to expect,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, is that what it's about, Sarah? Is I'm not going to be forced to think too hard about this or be confronted with something that I don't already know about.
Right. And, you know, like Matt said, when it feels like a warm hug when you read a book that might be familiar to you. So
right.
It's kind of like being surrounded by friends. And that's a very nice feeling when you read something that's familiar to you and it reflects back to you your life experiences, and it's just like you're with friends.
But the downside mm-hmm. is what?
You guys, there are downsides to always being in your comfort zone, aren't there?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, part of it, too, is also the avoidance of pain. Like, it's not just going towards something that's very comfortable. It's also avoiding the pain of, say, not knowing. You know, that can be, you know, maybe we don't think of it as pain, but that can be a painful experience when you feel a little bit like you don't really know what's going on. You feel a little bit less smart, maybe.
Inadequate.
Yeah, a little bit inadequate. And you don't want your books to make you feel that way. And I think that, you know, that can be one reason why people tend to stay, hold themselves back. And so then what happens is that you don't grow your knowledge. You don't, you know, see connections between books and genres and characters who are very different on the surface. You don't maybe necessarily come up with those aha connections as frequently as you otherwise might if you were reading outside of your, you know, your pain point.
Oh my gosh, that is such a great point too. Being uncomfortable is a growing experience, right? And something that, I don't know, maybe the older you get and the more kind of settled into what you think you know, you step away from rather than step towards.
Yeah, you can kind of learn from other people's experiences and different narratives and historical perspectives that are separate from ones that you've grown up with your entire life.
When was the last book that did that to you?
Oh, Ta-Nehisi Coates, We Were 8 Years in Power.
Ah, just now.
Yeah,
fairly new.
It's the best book I read this year.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
It's phenomenal.
So say a little bit about, I have a feeling you probably knew when you opened that book you were going to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
What was the experience like then of reading it?
So my comfort zone for reading is sort of, I mean, it's abnormal, but it is like the history that exposes you to a perspective that, you know, is very important. And Ta-Nehisi Coates' book does this really well. The exposure to his historical perspective that is maybe different than the traditionally accepted historical perspective allows you to see a part of the world in a way that enhances it and broadens it. And yes, it's uncomfortable to understand how somebody else engages with their history.
Right.
But it's tremendously important, and you're left a better person for engaging with those ideas.
Sarah, what was the last book that really, and maybe a recent book that really made you rethink what you think you already knew? Because I think that's the essence of reading outside your comfort zone.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I've been on this trajectory of reading a lot of books that are what we these days have been calling Black Lives Matter books. Mm-hmm. And so I've read and taught almost all of them. Duchess Harris's Black Lives Matter nonfiction book, just the way that she laid out the history of the way Black people have been treated, police brutality in the United States, and then pairing that with something like Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give.
We're going to talk about that book in a second.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And also looking at Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley's All American Boys and Kekla Magoon's How It Went Down, and just reading about all of these books together over the course of a couple of years with my students has been really illuminating. And also just thinking about it in the context of what we hear from the media. So, you know, one of the things that we talk about is this echo chamber of where are we hearing our news when it comes to things like Black Lives Matter and police brutality. And if you're hearing about it a lot from the people who are directly involved in it, then reading something like The Hate U Give is going to provide you with sort of a different kind of narrative, but one that sort of affirms what you're hearing. But if you haven't heard a lot about Black Lives Matter from the people who are directly involved in it, maybe you're hearing about it from other sources that distort what's going on with Black Lives Matter, then reading The Hate U Give or All American Boys can provide an alternative perspective that will maybe bridge some of that knowledge for you and help you build and help you be more empathetic and understanding of what's actually going on with police brutality.
Anitra?
This is so funny because as a Black woman, you know, reading outside of my comfort zone recently, I read Four Reincarnations, a book of poetry by a young white author named Max Ritvo. And he was dying. He is deceased now. And the book was written from that perspective of a person who knows that he is dying, a very young person. And I wouldn't have necessarily picked it up. You know, I was sort of like, oh, young young white male poet.
What's he have to say to me?
Right. What's he have to say to me? And also just the idea that he was so young and I have kids and, you know, they'd been kind of going through that phase that kids go through of talking about death and, you know, very frankly discussing my death, their death, the death of people in the world. And, you know, that made me very uncomfortable as a parent. And so then to dive into somebody who is facing death in this very clear-eyed, lyrical way was very scary to me at first. And it's such a beautiful book. It's filled with so much grace. It's filled with so much light and strangeness and beauty. And coming out on the other side, I felt almost a little bit more healed in a weird way. You know, I felt like I'd gleaned a little bit of his bravery and comfort and questing and thinking. You know, I could sort of imagine death and the death of such a young person, such a young, talented person, and not, you know, immediately collapse into a puddle.
Right.
And that for me was such a surprising experience. I really did not see that one coming.
Yeah, that book is incredible.
The Hate U Give is, I said at the beginning here, I was going to share one of the outside your comfort zone reading experiences I've had. And that was part of it, as I've never read YA literature before. And because I always thought I'm so far past that. And what is, you know, the experience of somebody who's 17 really have to, I know in Anitra, you're probably going a lot. and I learned that because Tracy Mumford, and I've talked about this, gave me an assignment of four YA books, and they were among the most meaningful reading that I did the entire year. And The Hate U Give was part of that.
Fantastic.
And what you said about the way it connects with what I'm covering these issues, but covering them from a journalistic and probably political way, never from the perspective that The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas gives from somebody that young, somebody who has lost somebody very close to them to this kind of police violence
twice.
That's right. And then the ambivalence she feels about doing the right thing, right around it. Super powerful, right? Matt, how about you as far as being able to enter somebody else's experience, as Anitra did with this young white poet who's dying and as we're saying about The Hate U Give. I mean, can you think of a book besides the Ta-Nehisi Coates book where you kind of said, I've heard a lot about this. I've seen the journalistic explanation of this. I lived it through this book in a way that I might not have. Kind of putting you on the spot, but there's a book that comes to you.
Yeah, for me, the answer to that is usually translated literature.
Okay.
So for me, it's Swallowing Mercury by, I don't know how to pronounce her name, it's Polish.
Okay.
And this book is about Poland and the political climate there. And, you know, to me, that is such a conceptual thing, that the cultural legacy of Polish political climate in the 90s and that sort of thing. But when you engage with literature that is translated or comes from a different culture, you can you sort of grasp an understanding through that, because you sort of see through these characters' eyes and how they see the world, which when it's from a different culture than yours, you're seeing things differently.
Be honest with me. How many people come in and buy translated literature? This is that Americans, I know. Why do you think we don't read more translated literature as Americans? Is it self-absorption? We're the center of the world? I don't know. Sarah, what do you think?
I think it's a lot of different reasons. We don't import as many books as we send out to other countries, and so there's just less availability. As well, we have a very rigorous publishing industry here that has a lot of, you know, we have a lot of our own stories. And so there's the issue of translating itself, that you have to have talented translators, you know, to do that work. And not that we don't have talented translators, but, you know, there's just extra layers to that work. And so when people go, for example, the children's lit community, when they go to the Bologna Book Fair, it's more likely that we will be sending out our children's literature than we will be importing children's literature from other places. And I know some of the editors who've done that work, like Cheryl Klein did that for Arthur Levine when she was there. And she would send books to me and ask me, you know, do you think this is a good book to bring in from Korea? And I'd give her my feedback. But, you know, it goes back to the conversation we had before about the diversity in publishing. So if there's not a lot of diversity in publishing, then the editors have to find people who can comment on those on those books in the original language.
Right.
So as a Korean American who can read and speak Korean, Cheryl knew that she could ask me to look over these books for her, but you know, there's still, it's a
I found that all the time working in publishing that when I was dealing with, you know, my counterparts in other countries, they routinely read in multiple languages and spoke multiple languages. And when I looked around, you know, like American publishing, you know, I didn't, you know, I knew enough of romance languages to do a little bit of damage, but not nearly enough to like read and comment on like a full length novel or a story collection. But that was so much more prevalent, I found, among my, you know, counterparts in other countries, that they, of course, they could read at least in one other, maybe even two other languages. And that didn't just seem to be the case with American publishing professionals. So,
so super valuable, too. I mean,
oh, yeah.
World shrinking, global economy. Yeah. The way we interact politically and economically and socially and culturally. And I just feel like this is a big miss in American reading.
And in the 1940s or late 1930s, 1940s, a woman named Yella Lettman actually founded the International Youth Library because she was concerned that we didn't know how to get along as an international community. So in this library, which is actually a castle in Munich, it's really beautiful.
Oh, wow. I've never heard of this.
It's phenomenal. Please look it up. But they basically bring in books from all different countries, and people can go there and read the books and study them. I have a number of colleagues who've gone and done fellowships there.
Wow.
I visited just as, you know, I happened to be in Munich, and so I visited. But she also founded the International Board on Books for Young People sort of around the same time, which does similar work where there's a U.S. BBY, there's a KBBY, a Korean Board on Books for Young People. And the work that they do is international exchange through children's literature. And so it's not that we haven't been trying to connect through international children's books. It's just that we just have not done it as well as we should have.
Well, and I wonder what you guys think, too, about, you know, I always feel like there's this greater perception, rightly or wrongly, of risk with translated books and risks with any books. I mean, because I think there's the idea that, well, if I pick up a book, it's this major investment of time. And, you know, like more than watching a half hour new show I've never seen, more than even going to a movie that I'm not so sure about. You know, when I commit to a book, it's like, oh, it's going to be this big time investment. And so I want to make sure that my investment of time is being placed as wisely as possible. And so the less you know, if I don't know who this author is, where they're coming from, it can just suddenly be as if the risk is too great. You know,
or even just the fact that they feel like they can't pronounce the main character's name or something like that. It just builds up that level of fear
and sort of like, where do I want to place my time, you know?
Matt, I was just thinking about the book that you recommended, The Brother. Yeah. That was a translation, wasn't it? I never would have been exposed to that book except for the fact that you were so excited about it.
Yeah.
We should describe what it is, it's because like now you'll have people come to subtext who want to buy it.
It's a wonderful like Western that would make Clint Eastwood happy. It's this story about karma and mafiosos and but it's Estonian.
And Anitra and Sarah say,
and
it's
an Estonian novel.
It's from Estonia, too.
Yeah, it's so wonderful. Good. It's wonderful. There are so many good publishing houses out there that do important translated literature. One of my favorites, the publisher of the Neapolitan novels by Elena Ferrante, Europa Editions, does some really fantastic work. One of their big initiatives is getting booksellers to be able to go to the Frankfurt Book Festival in Germany, because they believe that, and rightly so, that if booksellers are more aware and read more translated literature, then they're going to impart that upon their customers and grow the...
That is so true.
It's
a
really important
thing. And look
how
huge Elena Ferrante's novels ended up being, right? I don't... the readers that love those novels, I'd say a lot of them probably didn't know that they were originally written in Italian or care that they were translations, right? We should breach that barrier, I think, more often.
Once you fall into, you know, an amazing story,
right,
everything sort of can slip away, you know? It's like you just have to get over that risk-taking hump, you know? It's like just get over it. Dive in.
Think of
the Dragon Tattoo trilogy and how tremendously popular that's become. Yeah. And that, for me, was really difficult on multiple levels. Like, I mean, the violence against women in that book was so hard to read.
The politics of it were pretty complicated, right? The politics that really drove the story.
Absolutely. Right? But it was so well written and so well translated. And I listened to most of them on audio, and Simon Vance did a phenomenal job. And so there were multiple things at work to make me stay with that trilogy.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to a Friday Roundtable here, and it was inspired by a conversation that we had recently with Gene Luan Yang about reading outside your comfort zone. This is something that he's really committed to. He travels the country, and he thinks this is very important for young readers to read outside their comfort zones, and that it creates curious, empathetic, and well-rounded kids. And I wanted to take up that challenge and talk about it as adults on the roundtable today, because we all know that a lot of us who love to read fall into some pretty easy and secure comfort zones around what we're reading. And this is a call to you, as you hear us talk about this, to get outside your comfort zone. If you've done that recently, I'd love to know about the book you read that, I don't know, kind of turned you around, flipped your ideas. You took a chance. You took a risk on a book. Talk to me a bit about the experience of that on Twitter. It's at Kerri, KerriMPR. Matt Kelleher is with us from Subtext Books. Sarah Park Dahlen is with us from St. Kate's. And Anitra Budd is with us from McAllister College. We'll get a look at the latest news, and we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning, Kerri. I'm Phil Picardi from the NPR Newsroom. U.S. employers added a solid 261,000 jobs in October, and a bounce back from the hurricanes that slammed the Southeast in September. The unemployment rate declined a tenth to 4.1%. That is the lowest in nearly 17 years. But officials say the drop mostly occurred because many people gave up on their job searches rather than found work. The White House was on lockdown for a time this morning, and one person was taken into custody after reports of suspicious activity along the north fence line of the 18-acre complex. Pennsylvania Avenue and Lafayette Park were also closed to pedestrians. The incident occurred just minutes after President Trump departed the White House on Marine One to begin his trip to Asia. President Trump says he is disappointed with the Justice Department and will not rule out firing Attorney General Jeff Sessions if Sessions will not investigate Democrats. Trump says Sessions should be looking at Democrats. Trump pointed to a new book by Democratic Party operative Donna Brazile and told reporters they should look at Hillary Clinton's campaign. The U.S. gun death rate is up for the second straight year. The rate had been flat for about 15 years. Suicides account for nearly two-thirds of gun deaths, but experts say an upswing in gun-related homicides is a big reason for the increase. The numbers come from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And mourners carried candles and pushed bicycles along Manhattan's Hudson River waterfront last night. They honored the eight people killed in Tuesday's truck attack with a walk along the riverfront where the victims died. Saifuldo Saipov steered a rented truck onto the bike path, striking cyclists and pedestrians. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:29.
Programming is supported by North Memorial Health. Unlike the typical health system, North Memorial Health has customers, not patients, because customers take charge of their health. Learn more at northmemorial.com.
I'm Tom Weber. Happy Deer Opener. If you're heading to your shack or already there, tune in at 11 this morning to hear about the state's big picture thinking about how to manage deer in the future. A big plan is set to be released next year. We'll talk about it. Join us at 11.
After Tom's program at noon, it's a live National Press Club speech by the head of the FDA. You can tune into that on NPR News Presents beginning at 12 o'clock here on NPR News. The National Weather Service has issued a winter weather advisory for much of central Minnesota and Wisconsin starting at 1 o'clock this afternoon and lasting until early tomorrow morning. Snow is expected west central and central this afternoon, moving into Wisconsin by tonight. Snowfall could range from 1 to 3 inches near Morris to up to 4 inches in Anoka. Officials warn motorists to prepare for reduced visibility and some slippery road conditions. This is NPR News. The time is 10:30.
I'm Kerri Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable, and it's a roundtable committed to the idea of reading without walls. And on the roundtable, we're talking about what that means and our own experiences with that. And it was inspired by Gene Luan Yang, who writes young adult novels, mostly, Sarah, right? Young adults?
He actually has graphic novels for younger children, too. Secret Coders, Prime Baby. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that he talks about in this campaign is read a book about a character who doesn't look like you or live like you. What's he getting? And this is for younger readers, Sarah. What's he getting at there?
So basically, he wants us to read about people whose experiences are very unlike us. And when Jackie Whitson was on your show at Talking Volumes last week, she talked about the importance of mirrors and windows in our literature. And she was talking about Rudine Sims Bishop, who was a professor at The Ohio State University, and an article she wrote in which she talked about how important it is for us to see not only reflections of ourselves in the literature that we read, but also to have mirrors. To have windows so that we can see experiences that are unlike our own. We need both. We need to be affirmed and we need to be exposed. Mm. And so that's really what is at the heart of Jean's Reading Without Walls challenge. And I think it's just such a phenomenal challenge to all of us, whatever age we are, to read experiences about experiences that are unlike our own. A lot of us live in comfortable little bubbles, and reading is really a great way to break out of that bubble.
One of the things when Jackie was talking about that at Talking Volumes, I was thinking, I think we had just done a show about segregated schools and how we are resegregating, that many of us live in communities where there isn't a lot of diversity. Many of the kids are going to schools where it's one race or one amount of diversity, and schools that are often quite white because of the way parents are making decisions around this. And I was thinking, but for reading, you could kind of live your life, go into your church on Sunday and go into your school and go into your place of work and not have that window open to you that Jean is talking about. Anitra, would you reflect on that?
Well, it's funny because I was just in a small town in Wisconsin, and I was there to see a music show, and while I was there, I met the other two people of color in town. and that's not a joke. One of them, a black man, he came up to me, and I don't know if he'd heard through the grapevine, but he came up to me and he said, "Hi, I just wanted to introduce myself and just say hi." And you know, I thought about that and I was just like, wow, because I've been through, I love going to small town festivals, you know, like Corn Days and things like that. And I realize a lot of times when I look around, I am possibly the very first black person that
who's come to the festival.
Who's come to the festival, who has, you know, maybe there are kids there who, you know, they're little kids, and I might be the first person, the first black person that they've seen in person.
Aha.
You know, depending on how, you know, closely they've stayed in that town. And so that, you know, just that, like the enormity of that experience, because you think, you know, in 2017, you know, and I live here in Minneapolis, and I think, oh, sure, of course, you know, people have, you know, talked to black people, you know, they surely at some point in their lives. And then you just get just that little bit further out. And
right.
You're like, oh, no, my experience, my life, like who I am as a black woman is a very different, very different reality, extremely different. Just like, you know, I think more and more these days about how different my experience is from somebody living in a really rural town. Mm-hmm. You know, I lived in a very rural town for a small period of time when I was younger and haven't really ever since. And going to these small towns it stuns me all over again, you know, just how tight-knit it is, just how the concerns are so different from my concerns. You know, so it's that stepping out goes in a lot of different directions. Sometimes it's class, sometimes it's geography, sometimes it's age, sometimes it's race. So it can come in so many different directions, and I always try to be aware of that.
I'm really curious about where you were raised and
I was raised all over.
Around here? Or?
Mostly up and down the East Coast, but, you know, my dad was in the military, so we moved around a fair bit. So
mostly, though, you were in larger cities.
Mostly.
But
at least a significant suburb.
And what draws you out to these small town festivals?
because it's so...
It's going to be so different.
So different. Yeah. And I do feel like I'm very, very aware of my own tendency toward complacency, and it bothers me. You know, I'm a kind of person who, if I have to walk somewhere I've walked a million times, I try to walk different ways, just to jog myself a little bit. Because I can feel it. I can feel my thinking getting slower. I can feel my risk-taking minimizing when I don't purposely jog myself. I mean, and that's the thing where I'm really interested in how people get themselves out of their comfort zones. Yeah. Like, not just what did it, but how you do it. Because I'm always looking for ways to get out.
It has
of
to
my...
be pretty intentional.
It really, really does. And that's the thing. You know, I think, like, I, when I was making notes for this, I kept mentioning algorithms. It's so easy just by virtue of how we shop and how we consume books that we are directed down paths.
Oh my gosh.
If you like this, you'll like this. If you bought this, you'll buy this.
This is, I mean, yeah. And I had made a note about how Amazon and a lot of places, I mean, you're kind of the anti-Amazon. So what happens when...
that is me.
So Matt, except that, what happens when somebody walks into Subtext and says, I loved fill in the blank of the title and I want to read more like that? Aren't you, isn't it kind of incumbent on you to direct them to the place, well, here's three other authors that
absolutely
do what that there's, author did?
There's certainly a sense of obligation to make sure that that person leaves the store with something that they're going to enjoy reading.
Yes.
However, that doesn't stop me from putting three books on the table next to them
from
saying,
being subversive.
Maybe you should try these.
How do you think about that when you're mixing the recommendations?
Well, I usually start with... you know, simple questions. Tell me a couple of the last books that you've read that you've really enjoyed. But I also always recommend things that I really enjoy because when I'm passionate about something, it kind of comes through a little bit. And,
definitely.
And people want to latch on to that, I think. But yeah, I mean, the algorithmic sort of, if you like this, then you'll like that. You're just like driving a carriage through a rut. You're just digging deeper and deeper in the same thing. But when you take that turn and go into something different, you're exploring new bounds. And, you know, we mentioned at the top that people tend to want to stay within their comfort zone because it's safe. But getting outside of that, I mean, we talked about how it's, you know, fearful, you know, there's a level of fear there. But getting outside of that is exciting and it's new and it's fresh and it's an adventure. And there's a certain level of risk to it that you're going to get. But the rewards from experiencing that sort of stuff is endless.
You know, Sarah, I was thinking that this is something I miss about not showing up often enough at my library. Because, I mean, it was an event for me to go to a large library like the one in Roseville, and now I go to the one over in River Falls, and wander and have that experience of not always going back to the same shelf. But I find myself... you know, busier and access to, I mean, I'm overwhelmed with books. I don't do that very often. And I've lost kind of this serendipitous wandering the stacks.
That's the word. Yeah.
Right.
Booksellers are some of the last keepers of serendipity.
Yes. Yeah. We librarians have so much power to help people read without walls. And so, you know, in librarianship, we call it reader's advisory. When we advise readers on what to read next. And, you know, there are different ways to do it. And one of the things that some of my students do really effectively is the book displays. And so when you have books on a shelf and you only see their spines, they might not be as enticing to you. But if you see a book that is face out, then that can, and it's a really well-designed cover, then that can really draw you in. So I have students who worked at Minneapolis Central, and they, you know, they take advantage of that shelf that's about eye level for children.
Right.
And I remember specifically one of my former students, I just went in one day to visit her serendipitously, and she had this entire display of works just by Native authors. And today is Indigenous Peoples Day, so I really want to make a point of this. But it was phenomenal because the rate of outsider authorship on Native stories is way too high. And so for her to create a display of books just by Native people was something really tremendous. And it was the first thing you saw when you walked into the Central Library. So that was really great that
she
did that.
These are like the booksellers, I was going to say, tricks of the trade. But to lure you into reading something that you normally might not pick up.
Yeah, well, she mentioned...
Tell us all the secret tricks.
Books,
Matt,
being faced out. There are many things that I love about bookselling, but one of them is choosing which books get to be face out. Mm-hmm. And one that I do this all the time, and Anitra, you know this book, but it's Karen Tay I'm going to say her name wrong.
Yamashita,
thank you. Mm-hmm. Her book is I, Hotel, and it is such a wonderful book.
Phenomenal.
Like, if you read Thomas Pynchon, or if you read David Foster Wallace, or if you read any of those big, like, postmodern novels, this is the book you need to read. It's so good.
I met her at the Library of Congress this summer. The first Asian American Literature Festival was held in D.C., in July, and I almost died because she was one of my literary heroes. Mm. And also, when I was at the Library of Congress, I went to the children's reading room, and I was really pleased to see how many diverse books they had face out. And I also sort of went around and pulled out some more books and put them face out.
Yes.
That was sort of my gorilla.
Yes. Oh, my God. I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Yes, gorilla librarian. And I took photos and posted them on Facebook. Oh, and I was like, Shannon Gibney, look, I put your book face out.
I was in a Barnes & Noble just a couple months ago, and I was doing that.
Yeah.
And I was getting all irritated. Like, oh, there aren't enough books face out on these shelves. I'm like, I'm going to put some books face out.
Okay,
I need to lure people
in.
This is interesting because I always wonder when I walk into a chain bookstore. I wonder what the strategy is behind and the politics maybe a little bit behind the finances behind what faces that. Is that what it is, Matt?
Usually, yeah. There's promo deals and
there's a certain level of pay to play, you know, that goes on. I mean, shelf space is real estate.
Yeah. Right.
It's the same thing at grocery stores.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if you walk into, let's say, a Barnes & Noble, be aware that some of the books that are facing out to you and eye level, there's a reason for that. It doesn't mean it's not worth picking it up and reading a little bit about it, but
not always, but sometimes.
Yeah.
It's not universal, I wouldn't say. But.
Well, and that's where, you know, I mean, and that's where, again, it's like, sometimes you have to invent your own serendipity to get around things like that. So, you know, for me, like, a lot of times, like, I will pick a section that I would not normally walk into.
Give me an example.
Sports.
Yeah.
Sports. I'll just say that now. Sports. Also politics, again, like any kind of political science.
This is fascinating to me that political science just
doesn't
ring
do it
your
for
bell.
Me. But you know what? I read Primary Colors, and and that was...
That's an old...
It really is.
Did you read it recently or a long time ago?
A while ago.
Okay.
A couple of years ago. But that was for, you know, I was like, you know what? I should read something like a stalwart of the genre.
Right.
And it was fantastic. It was, right. And it really helped, honestly, for me, kind of helped humanize politicians a bit more than I went in. I mean, I did really kind of go in thinking, ugh, wheelers and dealers, all they're just in it for themselves.
What else is there to know about that?
What else is there to know?
This is a really good point because Primary Colors takes you deep into the motivation of politicians.
It really did. It was humanizing for me. And you know, I mean, I didn't realize just how inhuman I think I thought. but I had my stereotypes, let's just say. I had my stereotypes of politicians before I went into that. And it did a lot of work debunking some of those for me. So thank you, Primary Colors.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable about reading without walls. Anitra Budd with us from McAllister College, Sarah Park Dahlin with us from St. Kate's, and Matt Kelleher with us from Subtext. And asking you as you listen into the conversation if there's a book recently that really challenged your worldview, a book that isn't something that you typically read. Maybe it was recommended to you by a bookseller. Maybe a friend said, oh, you have to read this. And you thought, that's not what I usually read. Talk to me about the title and what the experience of reading that book was like. And you can tweet me at Carrie, KerriMPR. Okay, so I want to use this because I've said that this roundtable comes from Jean Luan Yang, who talked to us about it on a show recently. And he told the story about never being interested in basketball, sports, Anitra, until he read a book about it. And I think he said it inspired such an interest in the game, and now he's writing his own book on basketball. That is like
wow.
Right,
mm-hmm.
I know.
That's cool. Mm-hmm.
Like a 360-degree turnaround. I'm trying to think of some other area of a bookstore, Matt, Sarah, that I never would go to and that I feel like I should be drawn to. What would you draw me to, Matt, if I was at Subtext, as I will be soon? Buying books as gifts for people.
The poetry section is the section of my bookstore that everybody sort of like knows
avoids?
Is there, but like turns their shoulder to.
Really?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of reluctance to want to engage with poetry. I think it goes back to that fearfulness, not being able to understand the rhythm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, do I get it? But there's something about the way writers write poetry that is, it just, you can absorb it so much. you soak it up like a sponge, you know.
And I really come back to, you know, if you're thinking about risk, I mean, people, poetry, it's not that long. Yeah. I mean, you know, come on.
But you're meant to sit with it.
You are meant to sit with it. But still, I don't know. I mean, I was like, if you're going to, like, get in, like, I think all the time when I, you know, and I used to work in bookstores, you know, back in the day, and I would always try to lure people in with samplers.
No.
You know, like things where it's like, okay, you're afraid, you know, to walk down this road of a different genre, an author you're not used to. Why don't we look at an anthology?
Yeah.
Why don't we look at a collection?
That seems like cheating.
Well, no. There's no right or wrong here, you know.
Right.
And so it's the same thing with a poetry collection. It's short. It's small. You can fit it in your purse. You can fit it in your backpack. You can, you know, leave it in the bathroom. I always say it's like the thing you're maybe you're not interested in, put it somewhere in your house where you know you're going to be and you know you're going to, you know, put it out.
You know, what you said about risk, though, Anitra, when it comes to poetry, you said there's that anxiety that everybody gets this and I don't. We forget whatever we learned in, you know, middle school about reading poetry and that you'll be closed out kind of the reading experience, which is a shame. A lot of people think that about poetry.
It's such an unfortunate thing because you don't necessarily need to get it, right? You just need to engage with it. And, like, what you bring to it and what the perspective that it imparts on you is just as important as any sort of, like, overall understanding that you're going to get from it.
Sure. I mean, this is the reason I hate William Faulkner, and I've struggled for years because I just think everybody gets this, and I don't get Faulkner, and I avoid him.
Well,
you know.
And that's such a, I mean, taking it back to kids, you know, I look at kids and you know, they're not having that, you know.
I know.
Especially early, the earlier you grab them, they're not having these sort of angst-filled thoughts about not getting it. Or there's a right answer contained in this book and I have to find it because everyone else has found it.
But there are some books that engage with that kind of conversation. So Sharon Creech's Love That Dog has a lot of white space, and it's about a kid who doesn't think he likes poetry, and it's written in it's a book of poems, and the kid grows to love poetry, and he ends up meeting one of his literary heroes, Walter Dean Myers. I'm sorry, he meets him or he writes to him. Oh gosh, I don't remember now, but he plays a big role at the end of the book. And Kwame Alexander,
I was just thinking,
Kwame Alexander talks a lot about how his books of poetry can be really attractive to young readers who think they might not like poetry because he, like, visually too, the way his words are on the page, it's just so engaging and so inviting. So I think poetry is just a phenomenal way to read, and to read without walls, to read beyond your comfort zone, especially if you think you don't like it. Start with something like Love That Dog or The Crossover. Or
I was thinking,
you know,
about, I mean, we were talking, you know, earlier before the show about Balfi, a local poet.
Yes, I was going
to
say that.
When I try to imagine people not liking his work, it's so open, it's so engaging, it's so, you know, it's fun and fast and thoughtful, and it's, I mean, I was like, there's so many angles into his poetry. I'm like, you will find your way. You will find your way in.
Can you imagine if a young child reads the beautiful, you know, A Different Pond, which was inspired by a poem that he wrote, and then a little bit later grows up and realizes that Balfi has several poetry collections, Song I Sing and 10,000 Star Hotel, and then they read those books, and they have a foundation on which to understand 10,000 Star Hotel because they've read A Different Pond. And honestly, for me, reading his newest poetry collection was really, really difficult because of the violence in it. But because I have some understanding of the context in which he's reading, that it was that much more engaging for me. So I think it could sort of like be a scaffold in that way.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to put it. I mean, this goes right to, I think, Jean's third principle, right, of reading without walls, which is read a book in a format that you don't normally read for fun. And he uses the example, if you love graphic novels, read poetry. If you like literary fiction, try a graphic novel. So let's translate this to adults. I have to say, shaking up the format, other than poetry, because I read a fair amount of it for the show, but other than poetry, I can't think of a way that I really shake up the format of a book. this would be a good way for me to read outside my comfort zone. What
do you listen to audiobooks?
Mm. No, I, mm. See, okay, right there. Oh, Sarah.
Because there are some
Sarah,
really
you put your
phenomenal.
Finger on it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes. I first read The Hate U Give as an audiobook.
Did
I listened
you?
To it on audio, and it was very traumatizing because the narrator did such a good job. And I also listened to Ashley Hope Perez's Out of Darkness, which is historical fiction. Set in Texas, it's around the explosion at an elementary school and the racism of interracial
fiction
relationships.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Fiction, but fiction. Based on actual historical okay. events. And it is that book is also very traumatizing. So I had to go back and forth between the audio and the print because it was so difficult to listen to the audio when certain really violent things were happening in that book. So I would challenge you, Carrie, to listen to some audiobooks.
I went through a phase where I was getting them from the library, and I found myself, if the narrator, I made a decision about the narrator within like the first 3 minutes. And if I didn't like the narrator, that was it. It ruined the experience of the book, which is kind of foolish, but it's the way it was. And I think I missed out on books that I normally would have read because I'd made the decision about the narrator. What would you say?
Oh, I absolutely agree. If I don't like a narrator, it's really hard for me to stay with the book too. And then I'll either put it down and not go back to it, which is really unfortunate, or then I'll go and get it in print.
Okay.
But I've had pretty good luck, I think, with narrators. Before Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda narrated Aristotle and Dante, Discover the Secrets of the Universe by Benjamin Elire Sáenz.
Wow.
And that is one of the best audiobooks I have ever listened to in my life. And fun point, there's a line in there about Hamilton that Lin-Manuel has to read out loud. He takes a jab. But I think I've had really good luck with audiobooks. And if you talk to people, librarians or booksellers who've listen to audiobooks or the award-winning ones. There's the Odyssey Award given by the American Library Association. So if you look at Odyssey Award-winning audiobooks, and that's another really great way to sort of make sure that these books are well-read.
Sarah Dunn, thank you for the recommendation. I mean, absolutely. So I want to know what you guys have been reading and recommending, and we have a little. I've saved a little bit of time for you to tell me why. Anitra, what have you been reading and recommending to people?
Well, you know, this is an interesting thing for me because I have so many books that I've gathered from weird places that right now I'm in a zone of sort of reading down my pantry. I don't know if you ever do that with food where you're like, I'm just going to shop out of the pantry and I'm not,
so
you know,
great.
I'm not going to load up. So I'm reading through my book pantry right now.
Wow.
And right now I'm reading The Baron in the Trees by Italo Calvino.
Tell us a little bit about it,
why
you'd recommend it.
It is about a boy who gets in a fight with his parents. This is all happening in 1600s Italy, 1600s, 1700s Italy. A boy gets in a fight with his parents and he decides he's going to go live in the trees around his estate. And that's what he does. And he says, I'm not coming down. And he doesn't. And so he becomes, you know, the baron in the trees. And it's all about, you know, he meets this gang of boys. He starts this relationship with this girl who lives in a nearby estate. But he is in the trees. He is climbing from tree to tree. So it doesn't just have this beautiful sort of story of him growing up. It's also, how do you practically live in trees? How do you get around? And what does this mean? And for me, I love it so much because it's taking this very strange, outlandish idea. But really what it's wrapped around is how fights can calcify between loved ones, you know, like how you can feel so sure about a decision. You can feel so sure about a point, even with your family, your parents, and it can calcify into something hard and different and what that means for the whole family. So
the title again, because I'll get email.
The Baron on this. In the Trees.
The Baron in the Trees. Okay, Sarah, I'm saving Matt for last because he's probably got like eight.
So one of the books that I'm rereading right now, I read it earlier this year, and I'm rereading it now for class, is Cilla Lee Jenkins' Future Author Extraordinaire. It's a chapter book by Susan Tan. My friend Susan is biracial. She's Jewish and Chinese. And so her protagonist is also mixed race, Jewish and Chinese. And one of the things I love about this book is that it's for very young readers. It's a very young chapter book. And she talks honestly about the ways that she feels when this side of the family says or does something or doesn't say or do something. And then when the other side of the family kind of has issues with things as well. Also, another thing I really love about this book is that she wants to be a future author. And I think it's really important to show children of color wanting to be authors in children's books. And this is like so meta to me.
I know.
When Suzanne first told me about this
mirrors,
book, I was like,
walls,
wow.
Mirrors, yeah,
wow.
Windows.
Yeah. And so this is a book that I've been recommending to a lot of people. And particularly, I think here in the Twin Cities, readers might be really interested because we have a lot of mixed race families. And it's a delightful book. It's really funny. It's got great illustrations. I think it's going to be a trilogy.
Title again?
Cilla Lee Jenkins, Future Author Extraordinaire by Susan Tan.
Really good. Thanks. Okay. Matt.
So the number one book that I try to put in everybody's hand before they leave the store is a book of poetry by Dinez Smith called Don't Call Us Dead. That's on the shortlist for the National Book Award.
Right. Yes.
And it is so good. He's a St. Paul poet, and he's marvelous. I love that book.
What do you, when you say you try to put it in everybody's hands before they leave, what's your little elevator pitch to?
You're
at the door pitch.
Usually somebody comes in and says, yeah, I'm looking for a mystery. And I go, great, here's this book of poetry. it's just kind of on the cash wrap, and people usually like pick it up and take a look at it. And then I say, that's the best book of poetry this year. You should read it. And I have my little like shelf talker on it, and they're usually reading that. So I try to make it seem natural, even though it's usually not. The second book is the Ta-Nehisi Coates book that came out on the 3rd. It's wonderful. But a book that comes out in November that I cannot wait to start selling to people is called They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us by Hanif Abdurraqib.
I've been reading about this.
It's marvelous. So he is a very talented poet. He is also a music critic. And it's a series of essays about how he engages with music, but also it's about grief, and it's about America, and it's about life. And he's just such a talented writer. And he uses music as this gateway into all these other conversations about all sorts of things. It's one of the best books ever this year, and I cannot wait to start. So it comes out on November 14th.
And one book that I want to recommend, it's just fun. It's like Margaret Atwood meets Rainbow Rowell or something. I don't know. It's called The Power, and it's about what happens when this phenomenon kind of sweeps the world where 15-year-old girls suddenly discover that they've got electricity in their hands and in their bodies, and how that upsets everything that we think we know about power, mm-hmm. right? So it's a play, obviously, the power in their hands and their fingertips, but also the power. Have you read this?
No,
Have you heard about it?
List of things to read.
Here's the great thing about it. It doesn't take itself too seriously. So there's a lot of, there's some kind of fun inside joke sort of stuff. There's a little bit of futuristic speculative sensibility to it, but not in a way that, oh, this is a world I couldn't even. Sometimes when I'm reading Margaret Atwood's fiction, I think this is really a world that, do I believe that? Do I enjoy the literature? Yes. Do I believe this world? I don't know. In some ways, in The Power, I really believe the world. Yeah. Okay. Hey, thank you all for a great roundtable and lots of good reading recommendations. Good
thank
to have you,
you
here.
Thank you.
You.